Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 12, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Telephone Practice Group conference call. Today, we'll be discussing cybersecurity and the Mandiant Report. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to have opening remarks from each of our experts for about 10 minutes, followed by your questions. Richard Baitlick is Mandiant's Chief Security Officer with more than 15 years of experience in enterprise-level intrusion detection and incident response, working with the federal government, defense industrial base, and Fortune 100 companies. Paul Rosenzweig is the founder of Red Branch Law and Consulting. He formerly served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy in the Department of Homeland Security and twice as Acting Assistant Secretary for International Affairs. As is our habit, we've given you their full bios in the announcement of today's call, and it's available on our website as well. So with that, let's move right into our discussion. Mr. Baitlick, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean. Welcome, everybody. I'm glad you could join us for this afternoon's call. My name is Richard Baitlick, and I am the Chief Security Officer at Mandiant. Been at the company for about 2 years. Prior to that, I was the Director of Incident Response at General Electric, and I started tangling with Chinese and Russian and other hackers back in 1998. When I was a captain in the Air Force Computer Emergency Response Team. If you didn't know who Mandiant was prior to a few weeks ago, there's a good chance you know who we are now. We're a computer security company located with our headquarters in Virginia, but we have offices all over the country and a couple outside the United States as well. We released a report titled APT-1, exposing one of China's hacker groups. And what that means is we identified a group of intruders, really much more than a group, an entire military unit that goes by the designator 61398. That's what's called a military unit cover designator. And it's sort of a, not necessarily a code name, but it's sort of a shorthand for a Chinese military unit. What we discovered was that this unit is actually the second bureau of the 3rd Department of the People's Liberation Army. The 3rd Department is tasked with military intelligence and signals intelligence, and this second bureau was a group that specifically targeted Western companies. Now, Mandiant's work is all unclassified. We're an incident detection and response company. We're probably most famous for being the firefighters that you call if you have a severe incident. So the company is 9 years old, and for the last 7 years, we've been dealing with the wake and the aftermath, the damage caused by this group that we internally called APT-1. So beginning in 2006, we started tracking this particular group, and only in the last couple years did we decide that we would put some effort into doing attribution, in other words, finding out who these guys were, and then only in December of this last year, when we were working a case for the New York Times that became public later, that we decided let's go ahead and let the world know what's going on. We released the report because we felt that it was time to pierce through the denials that the Chinese government had been repeating for years and years. The problem of Chinese espionage dates back at least 10 years. And when I say Chinese espionage, it's well understood that pretty much all the governments of the world spy on each other in all directions, as you might imagine. The problem with the Chinese case, however, is that they go well beyond the, I'm not quite sure if established norms is the right word, but the norms that we have with other countries, such as Russia or even some of our allies. What, by norms, I mean it's understood that militaries spy on each other, that intelligence communities spy on each other, governments spy on each other. What's less acceptable is having a state group, such as a military unit, hacking into a manufacturer or hacking into a non-governmental organization or breaking into an individual's email account or going after the office of the Dalai Lama or 100 other industry types or victim types that I could mention to you. And that's what we felt was just beyond the pale. It's not just that the Chinese are so aggressive, it's that their reach is so broad and they attack not everyone, but almost everyone. In the case of our report, we outlined 141 companies that we had assisted over the last 7 years from 20 different industries that had all been breached and had data stolen by this group, APT1. And we felt like enough was enough. The victims wanted to say something, but there is really no benefit for a victim to come forward and say that they've been targeted by one of these groups. But that's changing a little bit. I want to say the ice is still very thick, but there's starting to be some cracks in the ice, and every once in a while, something changes. And I'd say one of the precipitating events that occurred recently was the New York Times coming forward to say they had been hacked by the Chinese and they wanted to tell the world about it. Prior to that, the number of organizations that had made that declaration was very small. For example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said that within the last 2 years. RSA said that they had been hacked in within the last 2 years. And prior to that, Google had said that they had been hacked. And all of these were by Chinese actors. And when I say Chinese actors, I don't mean people using Chinese IP addresses, although that could have been the case. I mean each one of those groups either did attribution or more likely they had help with attribution from some type of government entity. In most cases, it's the FBI because the FBI has a dedicated unit that works this out of the D.C. area. So we sensed that the world was ready to know what we knew about this one APT group. APT stands for Advanced Persistent Threat. It's a term that was invented by an Air Force colonel in 2006 as an unclassified way to talk about these particular threat groups. APT1 is only one of the two dozen or so groups that we track, and it is by no means the most dangerous or the most fearsome in terms of its capabilities, but it's wildly successful. It's the mass hacker of the Chinese threat groups that we track. What we were able to do is to put names and faces and locations and places associated with this group. What we found is that when you track a group for 7 years, they're no matter how good their OPSEC is, their operational security is, they're going to make mistakes or they're going to make bad choices. And some of the bad choices that this group made were doing things like when logged into victim computers, in other words, connecting from China into infrastructure in the United States or in other countries, they would do things like check their own personal email, log into Facebook. And again, this wasn't a regular occurrence, but they did it enough that we were able to see it by virtue of the security services we provide and use that as one of the ways to provide attribution for this group. In other ways, we were able to find out that these individuals were in this unit 61398 and tie it back to the fact that 61398 was actually a part of the PLA. It wasn't a club. It wasn't some other organization. It's an actual military unit. And we were able to do that using some open source research. Again, all of this is unclassified. By doing some open source research that found documents, as an example, an order to provide internet service for the new headquarters located outside of Shanghai for this unit, where they were China Telecom was pulling a new fiber line for this building, and they said that look, we really need to get this line in place. It's for Unit 61398. And by the way, if you don't know who that is, this is really important. This is the Second Bureau of the Third Department of the PLA, and you know what their mission is, and it's very important. So they outed themselves, in a sense, by virtue of these documents. And the only barrier you had there was a language barrier. If you didn't read Chinese, you couldn't understand what was being said. So that's just sort of a nutshell of what we found. We summarized all the details that we could, put it in a 73-page report. We also released 3,000 indicators or ways that companies could use to find this group active in their networks. We did it all for free, and a ton of derivative research is occurring now. Other companies, other individuals are looking for these groups, releasing new tools, releasing their findings, There should be a fairly decent story in the LA Times coming out this week, where they delved into some of the investigation we did and found more detail about these groups by doing some on-the-ground research. So I look forward to your questions, and at this point, I will turn it over to Paul.
Great, thanks. That's a wonderful introduction, Rich. I hope that the people who are on the call and listening understand the one most significant piece of what the Mandiant Report did. For 10 years or so, we've been talking about China as a cyber espionage threat actor in this space, and we've always been unable to decisively prove that the actors were sponsored by the Chinese government. There was always at least some possibility, often small in nature, that the denials were accurate, that they were maybe only tolerated or possibly encouraged. But what's really significant about the APT-1 report is that it's tied to a military unit of the Chinese government, of the Chinese army, and that makes it, at this point, impossible for China to continue to effectively deny responsibility for these for the types of espionage that are ongoing. That hasn't actually stopped the government from doing that. Just on Monday, Friday, the Chinese foreign minister called essentially all of these reports hogwash. The principal word they use is that it was an unprofessional report, which, after having heard Richard, I'm sure you can form your own judgments about that, and that the charge has been that the United States is sponsoring false allegations of Chinese espionage as a way of fostering its own budget and of creating problems for China in the international spheres, in the UN and all. So this is truly a significant report in some ways. So then I want to kind of change the focus of the discussion here and ask what to do. That is, what ought to be the legal and policy responses of the United States to what we now perceive to be an ongoing flood of Chinese espionage. As Richard said, under international law, espionage is not illegal. It's a common practice in international systems. It's true that all espionage is the violation of the domestic law of the victim country. When Chinese spies or Russian spies spy in the United States, that violates American domestic law. And likewise, when our spies are active in China or Russia or any other country in the world, we doubtless violate the domestic laws of those countries. But as a matter of international law, espionage as a national security measure has been accepted for quite some time. What is different about the Chinese espionage program is, as Richard says, that it violated the norms, that it went beyond espionage into national security secrets to become a wholesale program for economic espionage, often to the benefit of Chinese companies. One of the most notorious of these programs was one run a few years ago called Night Dragon, which targeted U.S. oil and gas companies who were in a competition for bidding against Chinese oil companies over some oil and gas leases off the coast of West Africa. Unsurprisingly, the American companies lost the bids. One suspects quite strongly because the Chinese companies had advanced knowledge of what the American bids would be and could craft their own bids to take advantage of that fact. So it changed from a national security law system, a national security law espionage issue, to a domestic economic espionage issue very quickly. And that's where we are right now. In literally the last 3 months, the ground has started to shift on the American response. Up until the start of this year, I think it's safe to say that the American governmental response in the executive branch was to avoid naming China explicitly as a as an economic espionage actor for fear of upsetting the apple cart, so to speak. And that makes some sense. I mean, obviously, I'm not in the administration, but even from the outside, one can readily see that there are all sorts of other things at play in our relationship with China, ranging from the South China Sea to worries about militarization of North Korea to economic issues that really have to play into that judgment. But beginning with the President's State of the Union address in February and continuing yesterday with a speech by a National Security Advisor Tom Donilon to the Asia Society, for the first time the United States has been willing to name Chinese actors as being hackers conducting economic espionage against American business interests. What's interesting about that is that even though they've taken that step, the government has not gone the next step, and that's the step of identifying the actors as responsive to Chinese governmental direction, the last step that was part of what the APT-1 mandate report has. Yesterday, Tom Donilon called upon China to exercise its enforcement authority to essentially rein in the rogue Chinese hackers who were stealing from American business companies. Now, perhaps that's a good move. It gives the Chinese a diplomatic way of putting a stop to the ongoing theft without acknowledging that they were responsible for it. But there are at least some who might say that unless and until we're willing to call a spade and actually name the Chinese government as a bad actor, we're unlikely to materially affect their activity. One measure of the difficulty of this is a report that was recently published, I think it was in The Economist, that suggested that Chinese economic espionage actually adds 1 to 2% to their economic growth rate, their annual GDP growth rate. And that's an awful lot of money. So unless and until an equivalent deterrent effect can be found, a way of deterring China can be found, it's quite possible that all the naming and shaming that the administration engages in is going to be unlikely to have an effect. So what I'll do at this point is close by just throwing out there a couple of ideas about how we might go further and actually be more aggressive. America might be more aggressive in responding to the Chinese espionage. One of the things that hasn't been done yet really is decisively identify which Chinese companies benefit from stolen intellectual property from America. It seems to me, and I actually got this idea from a friend at Purdue named Sam Lyles, that this is an area where we could unleash American hacker interests and make it a game and ask them to help us identify the Chinese companies that are benefiting so that we could apply directly sanctions to the Chinese companies that have benefited from stolen intellectual property. That will require a great deal more effort and resources than we've currently put to it, but if we make it into a challenge grant, a game sort of thing, that might actually generate some positive interest amongst the American the Silicon Valley community. A much more aggressive thing to do would be to try and figure out what Chinese interests need to be challenged and threatened as a way of getting their attention. Another study I saw suggested the possibility of beginning to poke holes in the Great Chinese Firewall as a possible adverse action. That would let information in, and information is probably destabilizing to the Chinese status quo, and that might provide an inducement to the Chinese government to actually rein in the hackers that they have. I have to close by saying that it's a very difficult and intractable problem. Both of the options I've just floated briefly, which we could discuss a great deal more, have obvious downsides. I mean, not the least of which would be, what if we actually succeeded in destabilizing the Chinese regime? That wouldn't be a good thing. So the end result might not be what we wanted. But on the other hand, what the Mandiant report has demonstrated quite decisively is that this is part and parcel of a large-scale Chinese governmental program. And with that demonstration, it's become, I think, incumbent upon the American government to develop a systematic response of some sort. And we have yet to really do that, though, as I said, the outlines are just beginning to show up. With that, Dean, I'll throw it back to you for questions.
Thank you. Thank you both, gentlemen. Let's see what the audience has on its mind now. We've got quite a few people on the line. In a moment, you're going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that prompt, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question on today's topic, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if people are going to ring in, let me make our programming announcement. We have two more telephone conference calls scheduled for the remainder of this week. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., please join us as Peter Wallison will talk about his new book, Bad History, Worse Policy. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. And then on Friday at 2 p.m., we'll be talking about a Federal Society white paper. It's going to describe some anticipated EPA policies. So that's Friday at 2 p.m. We've got one caller question, then our lines will be open. Again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
This is Marianne McGrail, attorney in D.C. What, in your estimate, are the most serious cyber threats today? Where are they coming from, and what are their primary targets?
Want me to take that one, Paul?
Yeah, well, you could start. I've got some thoughts, but I'm interested in hearing what you said.
Okay. We at Mandiant think about the world is different sets of actors. There are state-sponsored actors who conduct espionage, and there appear to be a small but I think growing number of state-sponsored actors who will destroy things. The only group that we've ever seen do that thus far appears to operate out of Iran. And in the unclassified world, I don't know necessarily if they are Iranian government or they're Iranian proxies, but this is a group that destroyed or deleted 30,000 systems at Saudi Aramco within the last year. Then on the other side of the state-sponsored divide, you've got all the groups that conduct espionage. And if you take a long-term view, you may consider that to be the most dangerous aspect. Then you have huge groups that do, they're organized crime groups that operate, quite a few of them operate out of the Eastern European area, and many of them are Russian, Ukrainian, and so forth. So if you're a company that's having money stolen from you, or an individual is having your identity stolen, from your perspective, that's an immediate problem you have to deal with. So it sort of depends on what you care about as to what the greatest threat would be, I think.
I'd jump in and second that. I mean, in terms of volume and something that's going to affect the average American on a day-to-day basis, it's standard crime and fraud. We lose billions of dollars every year to that. But in terms of national security, I think Richard's pretty much characterize it right. Today, the Director of National Intelligence, General Clapper, testified, and he said, and I think he's right, that there's only a remote chance right now of a major cyber attack against U.S. critical infrastructure. The people who have that kind of technical expertise, Russia, China, they're not really going to do that unless we get into a real shooting war with them. But there is a risk of isolated state or non-state actors like Iran or possibly some of the cyber hackers, if they develop a bit more capability, to do some attacks on some of the outer edge, poorly protected control functions in the U.S. networks, maybe power generation, for example. And the best example of that is, in fact, Iran, with both its attack on Saudi Arabia and its likely participation in the denial of service attack on U.S. banks last year. That's about the top edge of the really destructive pyramid, and if it were me, I'd be investing most of my time and energy in crime and espionage issues.
All right, we have one more caller question at this point, then our lines are open. If you have a question, you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Good afternoon. David Thompson, government relations firm in town. Just curious what you see as the federal response required to respond to the increase in private companies that are looking to strike back, and kind of using the analogy that, you know, if you dial 911 and the cops don't show up, you have a right to defend yourself, and you're starting to see a lot of private companies feeling like they have that autonomy. What is the federal response to that as you see?
This is Paul. I'll start with that one, and then I'm sure Richard will chime in. The federal government doesn't like that. you know, the Department of Justice is pretty much officially of the view that U.S. companies that strike back in an active way, not just in the defensive and analytic mode that companies like Mandiant do, but in more aggressive ways that take action that affect other people's networks, are running afoul of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And that's a criminal statute. If I were general counsel to any major company, right now I'd recommend against being too aggressive in that regard. That doesn't mean that that I think that there's no scope for that. There's a new company out there called CrowdStrike, and they did a demonstration just this past week at a conference San Francisco, where, I might add, with the Department of Justice's permission, they showed how they had decapitated a very bad, very virulent botnet network. So there's room for private sector actors to be force multipliers, but right now the law hasn't caught up to that capability, and I think that's probably right. I mean, think of the Mandiant report itself. One of the threat actors that you might have shot back at was the Chinese government. And, you know, I'm just not totally on board with the idea that private sector actors might start the first cyber war with China inadvertently. Richard?
I think that's right, Paul. All the companies we meet with, there is an emotional response to this. You want to know two things: who's doing it, and can I go get them? And I hear this many times. And it turns out, once you involve the legal community, and I think this is correct, this is the right thing to do, a more conservative approach is taken, where you say, what is the benefit to us as a company, honestly? And secondly, what do you hope to gain by this? And is it possible for a company that can't even defend itself from one of these intruders to somehow be able to launch an offensive attack? It doesn't make any sense to me that the way that you're going to respond to being extremely vulnerable is to potentially make the adversary more aggressive. These guys don't back off. If you push on them, they push back. I've seen this firsthand dealing with these guys. So it doesn't make any sense to try to hack them or to do anything like that. Unless you are a government actor and you have a plan and you have some experience and you can run these operations and protect the fact that you're running the operation from the adversary. It is an example. Whenever you hear somebody talk about running a deception campaign, the organization for that deception campaign is going to be done on the same network that the adversary is usually controlling, and they're watching your email, they're watching your screen, they're watching your typing. So as you're discussing how you're going to run the deception campaign, the bad guy is reading it firsthand. So I really think before anyone would consider any type of offense, you really need to get your own house in order. I mean, just from the Mandiant perspective, we put a big target on ourselves by calling out this Chinese group as being a military unit. So, and we've been dealing with the consequences of that. And we're one of the world's best security companies, if not the best, in my opinion. So this is not something for the faint-hearted to just say, yeah, we're going to go hack the Chinese or hack the Russians or whoever you think might be attacking you.
The switchboard is lighting up now. We've got quite a few people in the queue, so we will try and get to all the questions. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Mike Stern in Washington. I wanted to follow up on Paul's suggestion that if you were able to identify the beneficiaries of some of this espionage, that one could follow, one could seek some sort of sanctions against the companies that benefit or the government, I'm not sure which, but I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit, and specifically, would a company that is a victim of espionage, if you could identify the beneficiary, could you seek some sort of sanctions directly against that company?
Hi, Mike. Good question. Asking me to kind of elucidate, elaborate on the issue. If I can pick kind of all of the above, that would be my answer. There was a famous case a couple of years ago, a furniture company in Pennsylvania that was put out of business because its designs had been exfiltrated outside the country, and surprisingly, 6 months later, identical pieces of furniture at cheaper prices were being imported from China, undersold them, and they lost the company, they lost the business, people were out of work. I would have no problem with a set of rules that, if it were capable of doing so, and identified that company forensically in a way that would be provable in court, everything from trade sanctions against that company to and prohibiting its imports to authorizing a damages action by the victim company against the beneficiary. It's akin to receiving stolen property. The circumstances are such that we would likely be able to establish that to a sufficient degree that the inference would be that they knowingly received the stolen property. Yeah, nobody gets designed stuff like that just kind of over the transom. And so I think that the potential sanctions should range from official government action involving customs, tariffs, duties, and penalties to trade sanctions to possible civil actions. Of course, the problem with civil actions is you're going to have a difficulty finding assets to execute a judgment against, but that's something that we'd have to work out a little more detailed as well.
So that question, I'll just briefly state, that is one of the key questions that is not yet answered. Give me great cases that show theft of our stuff going into their stuff. And there's sort of fringe evidence, and there are a couple of cases, like the case that Paul mentioned is actually a really great one, but we need more of that. We need more of these cases where someone has done enough research. And you'd think the companies would be doing this, but honestly, many of the companies that are victims of this activity are doing business in China. I mean, if you want to know who's being hacked by the Chinese, scan the newspaper for anyone who's doing a deal over there. Are they doing a joint venture? Are they doing research and development? Are they putting engineers in the country? Are they trying to open up a factory? I guarantee you all of them are hacked. So none of them want to come forward and say, yeah, we made this business decision to do business over there, and we're hacked now, and point out, yeah, that thing you see them producing is actually ours. Nobody wants to do that. But that's really what it's going to take. We need much more of that being shown. And I can give you an example of a case where it's fairly famous and there's some background details that you can dig for on the internet. I think a lot of people are familiar with Huawei's theft of Cisco's source code. This is well documented. There was even a lawsuit, which is how it came to light. After the lawsuit, Cisco has said, in at least one presentation I found publicly, they regretted bringing the lawsuit because they felt it hurt their chances to sell into China. Because whenever the Chinese IT buyers saw Cisco, they just thought about, oh, that terrible American company that accused Huawei of stealing their stuff. Which was true, but it basically essentially shut Cisco out of the market. So you've got people who are making the decision, even though our stuff was stolen, we don't want to offend the Chinese market. So solving this problem of showing real damage caused by this, and Paul was also right when he brought up, it's not just trade secrets. It's the Chinese want to know if they're going to put someone into the IMF in the number three position, what's the rest of the world going to say? What is the rest of the world's positions on a certain activity before they go to the ASEAN conference or any of these sorts of things? It isn't just trade secrets. It's what is the world, how is China interacting with the rest of the world?
All right, we have six callers with questions at this point, so we'll try and get through all these questions. Let's go to our next caller. Hi there, this is John Reed at Foreign Policy Magazine. And we've heard more and more about the black market and how powerful the tools that are
available on the black market are. They're cheaper, they're easier to use, and I believe the CEO of Mandiant even said that they're starting to get to the level that was reserved for nation states a few years ago. And the DSB report recently said that red teams were able to penetrate Pentagon networks using off the black market tools. Can you talk about how fast the capabilities in these tools are growing, where they are, and how that's going to change security if, destructive tools, potentially destructive tools, aren't just going to be the domains of Russia, China, even Iran? If anybody can get these, what's that mean?
So, hey, John. Now I know why you're tweeting. The tools, it's just a question of intent. Almost anybody has the capability to build something destructive. All you need to do is to deliver it, get it onto somebody's computer, and have them execute it. And you can immediately wipe their computer. The next step is, well, how do you get that thing to proliferate? Once you've solved the proliferation problem, how do you expand from one computer to the next? At that point, the only thing that's stopping you is either an IR team, an incident response team, who sees what's happening and can cut it off, or segmentation of the network such that whatever this tool is can't just propagate. All of the worms, all the viruses, the automated malware that was popular 8 to 10 years ago, if the writers of any of those things had decided, I want to go from computer to computer and delete, they could have done that. It was just a question of intent. So these days, 10 years later, you could just as easily have something like that happen. And from the reports that I've seen about Saudi Aramco, it was something that was introduced, and then quickly it spread to 30,000 computers before they could stop it. So it is really just someone saying, we want to do this to you, and we're going to deal with the consequences if you find out who's doing it.
I would just add that the transition in threat actors is going to be a significant challenge. Right now, even with the Iranians who are breaking stuff, we have a sense that they are fundamentally rational actors at their core, as with Russia and China. When the tools become so well developed that irrational actors can break things for irrational reasons, it's going to really change the game a great deal.
All right, next caller.
Hi, Dean and others. It's Bill Plotkin. Quick question as to what and when is there a tipping point for a full-on government response, whether that's diplomatic or more. We've read, anyone reading regularly the Wall Street Journal editorial page last week, there was a pretty alarming article on a cyber attack on the electricity grid, despite the Clapper's remote chance comments today. At what point are we going to be reactionary, or is there a tipping point for the government to set out a policy decision saying, it'll be an equal and opposite hard reaction? At what point is there a tipping point? And is it based on attacks on infrastructure? Is it attacks on government? Is it continual mountings of Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Chamber of Commerce? How often do the Chinese or whomever else have to attack before there's this point reached where there's a strong response and something definitive? Thanks.
Well, this is Paul. I'll offer it this way. This is part and parcel of a much larger relationship with China. And so it involves a whole host of factors that are there. There's no black and white answer. I mean, from my mind, the degree of Chinese complicity in espionage has grown so great that we're well past the time where we should have publicly called it out and begun developing a strategy for responding to it. I would advocate that that strategy should have all components in it: diplomatic, intelligence, economic, financial, legal, anything that's within the tools of what we have. But I would also advocate that it has to be done with caution in light of other issues like North Korea, the South China Sea, ASEAN, the economic factors, etc. So, I don't think we've reached the tipping point of a full-scale assault on China yet, and I doubt we will for any time in the near future.
I think that's well said, Paul. I can't add to it.
All right, next caller.
Hi, this is Dave Wilson from Titan Info Security Group. Wouldn't you agree that the hacking at this point has become extremely prevalent, and a lot of companies, rather than waiting to find out what's going to happen, are taking matters into their own hands, sort of under the radar, and that we'd be better off, excuse me, rather than waiting for some sort of government plan or response, allowing companies who have the skills and knowledge to be able to help defend these companies and put some pressure back on the hackers?
What I'd say is that anyone who has a legal department, as soon as your legal department finds out, they're going to put the kibosh on it. It is not something that I've found any company that has a lawyer says that this is something they're going to do.
Well,
now, I do have some fragmentary...
Let me just say real quick.
Yeah.
I've talked to a lot of companies who said that their legal company said, yeah, let's go ahead and do it, and they've actually accomplished it. I can't give names, but...
Well, I was just going to say I have some fragmentary evidence that there are some in the financial industry who have contracted with third parties in Amsterdam and Israel mm-hmm. to fish around for this, and I would put that in the category of hiring private investigators to go find out information. I mean, that was prevalent when I was doing incident response work involving remaining organized crime and that sort of thing. So I don't necessarily consider that to be hacking back, but... I mean, if that is happening, if someone is deciding they're going to go break into somebody else's network and the press finds out about it, that's going to be a blockbuster story that I don't think anyone would be proud to be associated with.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. And I think they'd also hear from the government pretty quickly because they're going to stomp on a lot of government activities.
Well,
yeah.
You know, and I can cite at least one instance where they did that, the full knowledge of the company, and they did bump into a government organization. And the exchange was the government organization was upset about them disrupting their investigation, but that's as far as it went. And as far as the company was concerned, they were just as upset at this organization because they didn't tell them all their data was being exfiltrated.
Yeah, sad story all around.
We've got three more questions queued up at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Roger Candelaria. Great presentation, gentlemen. I really appreciate it. I have two questions. One is if you would be so kind as to give a hypothetical of let's assume that I have the skills to hack into some system or something, and I don't want to destroy anything, but I want to somehow profit by it. What's a typical scenario of how somebody, what do they see as their gain, their upside to it? That's question one. The second one, I read someplace that in the United States there are something like 55,000 university students from China. And I wonder if their local access to so many networks, not just universities, but the companies at which they intern and are generally open society, if that poses the same risk or different risks than what you described coming from the Army unit in China. Thank you.
You want to, I can do the second one if you want to do the first of those, Richard.
Yeah, I can do that. So there's a great presentation that happens every once in a while at Black Hat by a friend of mine named Jeremiah Grossman. And he calls it Get Rich or Die Trying. And he goes through what are the different ways you can make money off of hacking, starting with a couple pennies per victim up to outrageous amounts. And currently, the last time he did the presentation, the most outrageous way to make money was to hack into government agencies that offer licenses that are very expensive to acquire. And he gave an example of logging the Amazon in Brazil. So there was apparently cases where hackers broke into the licensing authority for this Brazilian agency, and it would cost them millions of dollars to get a license to log in the Amazon. So hackers were stealing, or they were generating fake, they were fraudulent licenses, but as far as the government agency was concerned, they were real because they had come from this agency. And the intruders, these organized crime groups, were selling these licenses to loggers. And they were making millions of dollars per license. So if you want to get into hacking and you want to make a ton of money, that's the way. It's to corrupt some government process where there's a huge payout. Now, there's plenty of other ways we could talk about it, but I'd prefer not to give you all ideas of what you can do after the phone after the phone call.
Yeah, no, I think Richard's hit on it exactly, which is basically the real money is in suborning any lucrative financial process of some sort, whether it's a licensing regime, a money transfer regime, a purchasing regime. They're all vulnerable. As for your other question about the presence of foreigners in our society, you know, that's a mixed blessing. The truth is that that some of the cyber threat is an insider threat, that often some of the penetration is not from the outside by groups like the unit that Richard identified, but rather from insiders who achieve access. That's particularly true of really secure systems that are not attached to the network, that are isolated from it by an air gap, and that you require a physical presence to get across. So there's some risk in that. But the truth of the matter is that we also tend to think that, you know, their presence in our open society inculcates them with our positive values, and hopefully they go home and they change China rather than staying here as spies. I have had experience in at least one program with a lot of foreigners in it, in which a CIA officer advised the faculty that probably 1 in 10 of the matriculants was already in some way associated with a foreign power, and that we should therefore be careful. So your fear is not unreasonable, but it's, you know, we can't close off the society. Are we going to just not allow people to come and study here? It's a hard one to answer.
Well, this is Dean Reuter again. You guys seem to be generating more questions than you're answering. We still have 4 questions on the board. So I'm going to caution our callers to be as brief as possible so that we can try and get through as many of these questions as possible.
Hey, thanks. This is Tricia Pauletta from Wiltshire Grannis. I recently attended a transatlantic cybersecurity panel hosted by the European Institute. And the European official also noted that they suffer a lot of Chinese hack. And I just was wondering, are you aware of any discussions between the two governments, between the U.S. and the EU, to do some kind of concerted response, maybe not a cyber attack, but additional investigation and some kind of concerted approach to the Chinese government, you know, united front? Thank you.
Well, that's a great question. When President Obama was over meeting with the EU, I guess it was late last year, they set up a U.S.-EU cybersecurity coordination group. And my understanding from colleagues at the State Department is that developing a unified approach to China is on the agenda of that group. I guess I would have to say it's too soon to tell, right, whether they'll be able to do that or not.
I've got nothing to add to that one.
Okay. Next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that we have a problem that's been neglected here, which is the fiduciary duty of managers of American companies that do business with foreign nations or companies in foreign nations, where the our counterparties really have no serious intention of complying with our agreements concerning the protection of intellectual property or any other terms of contracts we might make with them. So since we're not prepared to go to war with them, it seems that managers have a fiduciary duty to inform shareholders that in doing business that may show up as a profit in the next quarterly report, they are actually killing the company. And the shareholders need to make their investment decisions accordingly.
Who wants to respond to that?
Well, I mean, that's the same problem that faces all corporations who are doing business in China or any other place with with a challenging political environment overall. In general, you know, American corporations are wealth maximizers, and they're trying to make the best judgments about which way they're going to go. I am not aware of any shareholder actions that have been taken against major corporations for engaging in business in China. And I suspect that we won't see many because fundamentally the risks seem to outweigh the gains, as Richard said. I mean, the gains seem to outweigh the risks. As Richard said, everybody goes to China even though they know that they're going to get hacked. And that seems to reflect the judgment that they all think they'll make more money than they'll lose.
I think that's exactly right. John Rice, who's one of the top five guys at General Electric, recently was on CNBC, and he admitted, we get hacked all the time, quote, and the answer is to innovate faster. So you've got to make a decision as to whether or not you think that strategy works. And if you think it does work and it's worth getting access to that market, then you invest in that company. And if you feel like that strategy is going to kill the company in the long term, maybe that's a company you don't want to invest in. And I do think the SEC has a really important role here, and they have been getting more vigorous over the last year in pulling these details from companies about who among you have been hacked and what have you done about it. And then at least with that information as a shareholder, you can make a better decision when you pair that against the business strategy.
Let's take another question. I think our caller's been disconnected. Are you there, caller? You might need to unmute your telephone if your telephone is on mute. Okay. We still have one question pending. If you want to join the queue, we still have got about 8 minutes left, maybe time for a second question. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Thank you, gentlemen. My name's Sylvia Ross. I'm out here in Loudoun County, and this may sound like a strange question to you all, and I tuned in because we recently had here in Loudoun, and you may have seen it in the papers, a controversial charter school that was supposed to be a science and technology school and had a lot of backing from corporations because they are concerned with this lack of cybersecurity knowledge, and this charter school was linked to a controversial imam from Turkey out of the Pocono Mountains, and it's been sort of in the public news nationally. There's a series of these schools, and with the way Turkey is moving in its relations with the U.S. and this imam's influence and the link to these schools, how do you see any of this? One, is it appropriate to be using local government, in a sense, to be paying for this type of education component with corporations backing it, when it may in the long run affect, you know, national security? Why would a foreign country want to build schools here and have our children be cybersecurity experts? And this may be a question that you just don't have an answer to, and that's okay.
I've actually heard of this story. I don't know any of the details outside basically what you communicated. My only sense is that there are certain societies who are trying to develop more soft power. The Chinese are definitely doing this with their Confucius Institutes. Mm-hmm. So perhaps this type of outreach is a way to project more soft power for this particular culture.
Is there any way of informing corporations in some of this? Paul, you know, they might want to think about, you know, checking a little bit more who they're backing for the sense of gaining cybersecurity experts from sixth grade on up.
Certainly, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, gentlemen, we might not have set a record, but we might have approached a record for the number of questions asked and answered. I commend you both, but it looks like we're out of questions. Let me give you each a chance to wrap up, and in doing that, let me ask Richard Baitlick in particular, what's next for Mandy, and do you have another major report in the works, or anything else you can share with us about your next step?
Well, everyone's asking, will there be APT-2? And the answer is no. There will be no APT-2 report. We think we've achieved our goal of raising awareness about this issue and forcing some policy action, which is great. We're also cognizant that if we were exposing more groups, perhaps more sophisticated groups, it becomes more difficult for us to track them. APT1 is fairly, I won't say easy to track, but we're able to keep up with them even though we've exposed their details. There are other groups that we may only have a few ways to track them, and if we expose them, then we lose that. It's a classic Intel gain-loss decision that has to be made. So what we are doing, though, is the same thing we've been doing for the last 9 years, is continuing to catch as many intruders as we can and try to do our part to protect our secrets and keep us competitive.
Paul Rosenzweig, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I'll end with one thought and just broaden the lens a bit, which is that the bilateral competition between the United States and China is part of a much broader discussion that the world is just beginning to undertake, which is really about the fundamental nature of the cyberspace network and what international governance is going to look like going forward. You know, you saw that a little bit in the last 2 days. Tom Donilon said, you know, we want to talk with China directly in bilateral negotiations about what a proper behavior is. And China, who want very much to move the entire scope of internet governance to a multilateral forum like the International Telecommunications Union, responded today, one of their defense ministers, by saying, we would love to talk with the United States about norms in a multilateral forum. So all of this is tied in very much to a long-term dispute about who's going to run the internet, who's going to run the network, who's going to set the rules of the road for the next 20 years. Maybe that's worth another complete forum for you, Dean, but I just thought I'd mention that as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. This is the first in a series for our international and national security law practice group focusing on cybersecurity. So there will be, and I urge the audience to be on the lookout for future Teleforum conference calls and other programming centered around cybersecurity. Let me thank both Mr. Richard Baitlick and Mr. Paul Rosenzweig for joining us today. As I mentioned, you gentlemen fielded a lot of questions, so we certainly appreciate you participating in our call. To our audience, a reminder to join our call tomorrow, if you're able, at 3 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number, when we'll be discussing Peter Wallison's book, Bad History, Worse Policy. In the interim, before the call tomorrow, you can learn more about the book on our website by checking our Teleforum calendar, which has a link to the book. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.